This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. A quick look at my name tag, and I can assure you, I'm your host, Norman B. We're going to discuss two new books in this edition. Later in the show, Jill Cement will join us to talk about her latest novel, The Body in Question. Now, I want to prepare you for this because we're going to touch on topics that some listeners may find taboo: sex, age, and death. And I'll make sure you get ready for that. First, the title, The Good Vices, From Beer to Sex, The Surprising Truth About What's Actually Good for You. The authors, Dr. Harry Ofgang and Eric Ofgang. Gentlemen, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, let's distinguish who's who. So first of all, I'm going to sort of see if we can discover this by the sound of your voices. Dr. Harry, can you say something for us?
Good morning. We're glad to be here, and thank you for having us.
Okay, and then Eric, let's hear from you.
Hey, yeah, how's it going? We're happy to be here as well.
Okie doke. Okay, we've got you sorted out. We know which one is which now. There's something that you say in the introduction to your book that I think is really worthwhile talking about. And this is, I'm going to read just a couple of lines. You say, conflicts of interest in healthcare are such that a 2009 report by the National Academy of Sciences, sponsored by the National Institute of Health, found, and then you list a whole number of things about drug companies. Can you talk about this? Because I think this is so pertinent to what you then go on to talk about in your book.
Originally, when we started thinking about a book, I was interested in writing kind of a how-to book on health and natural health. And my son, who's a health journalist, is more investigative and so on and so forth, and had done articles for Connecticut Magazine on some of the drug industry and so on and so forth. So after back and forth conflicts and arguments and so on, we compromised on actually not having either, not having a health advice book, having a book that was fun, where people could enjoy life, was light, was an easy read, and that would also possibly make them a little healthier. So we kind of combined the idea of being happy and having fun with health, but we didn't leave some of the previous ideas behind. And what happened was we did have a couple of separate chapters on why it's a good idea to take some drugs, even prescription drugs, with a grain of salt, so to speak, and question the efficacy and question the need for so many drugs. And we know with the opioid epidemic and so on and so forth that there's a lot of this has come out, but that's not helping the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who are taking drugs that were prescribed that perhaps weren't needed. Now, we're not talking about drugs that are prescribed that are needed, that are life-saving. That goes without saying that those are important. But in fact, the introduction pretty much says it all. There's a lot of conflict of interest. There's a lot of self-serving studies and so on and so forth. And the average person can suffer from that because a lot of those things are not sorted out and not done with the utmost integrity and scientific investigations.
Eric, let me ask you about putting the book together. There is a sense of humor running through the book, and there's a sort of there's a historical theme running through the book. You give us a lot of history about the different vices, and I want to get into the word vices in a moment. But I just want to know from you, putting the book together, you seem like you had fun. You and your father had fun putting this together. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we absolutely did have a lot of fun. It wasn't all fun. You know, there's definitely parts where we were, you know, getting into the nitty-gritty of word choice and how to fit certain things into a chapter and things like that. But I'm glad you picked up on the historic aspect. I just always have been fascinated by history and the both the stories behind why we drink and eat what we drink and eat, and why we think about the foods, you know, what we do about what we eat. And I'm always, you know, fascinated by that and sort of the folklore of a lot of these different behaviors we have. So I just, you know, included a little bit in a lot of the chapters on that, to just sort of introduce
yes.
Each vice or each behavior. And, you know, I think it helped, you know, helped lively up the book, but also helped bring in a little bit of the story about, you know, why, you know, we have a feeling about sleep, why we feel the way we do about sleep, or what some of our thoughts about that or things like that are. So, you know, that was part of it. Definitely, we didn't want the book to be, we wanted to include a lot of studies, and we wanted it to be really scientific-based, but we didn't want it to be kind of laden and difficult to get through. We wanted it to be very readable. And so we would, try to insert a lot of humor as we went.
Dr. Harry, your specialty is in, well, you explain for my audience, because I don't want to take the words out of your mouth. Can you explain to my audience what your expertise is?
Well, I started out studying conventional medicine in Europe, and then finished getting a degree in naturopathic medicine in Portland, Oregon, the National University of Natural Medicine. And so my specialty is in treating people naturally. And naturopathic medicine is a system that, when possible, uses safe, effective, gentle treatments, both traditional and modern, to kind of boost the person's immune system, have them have the self-healing process take place, you know, whenever possible, avoid more toxic big guns, so to speak. That's not to say, again, that we disparage those big guns. They're sometimes needed, and when they are, they're indispensable. So modern naturopathic medicine incorporates both conventional and naturopathic modalities, but tries to emphasize prevention and holistic health for the patient at the outset. And it makes sense. Why take out the big guns when something simple like a simple botanical medicine or a homeopathic remedy or something like that will help?
Yes, I've noticed from talking to interviewing doctors over the last few years that natural healing and natural medicine is coming, I'm not going to say coming to the fore, but it seems to be much more accepted now than it was for quite some time. Am I right in that?
Well, to a degree, that's true. For example, naturopathic physicians are licensed doctors in, I don't know the exact number, but maybe 18 to 20 states. 40 years ago, there might have been a handful of states. So there's they're being recognized, and people are definitely embracing a more gentle, natural approach. On the other hand, there are, as even with the advent of the internet and so on and so forth, there's a lot of information, and there's it's very easy to influence that the information and promote certain modalities over other modalities. So there's a lot of special interest, and natural medicine, in my opinion, has taken a back seat in some cases in terms of funding and research.
I'm talking to Dr. Harry Ofgang and Eric Ofgang. Mm-hmm. The book is called The Good Vices, From Beer to Sex, The Surprising Truth About What's Actually Good for You. Gentlemen, I want to focus in on your book, but before we get into the chapters, there's one word that stands out that I've got to ask you about, and that is vice. I looked it up in the dictionary, and the first notation that comes up for vice, immoral or wicked behavior. I don't think having sex is immoral.
Neither do we.
So I'm just presuming that in some respects that is part of the humor that you put into the book, The Good Vices, the title.
Well,
I mean,
it is part of the humor, and it also, to a lot of people, sex is a vice. And, you know, not to us, but to a lot of people it is. And we also present some studies that show that having a little bit more sex gives you a lot more benefit in terms of health. So we're dealing with perception, but you're definitely correct that the book was meant to be, it's not meant to be a heavy-handed health advice book. It's meant to be funny and witty and things like that. So yes, that's, sex to us is far from a vice.
Thank goodness for that. Okay.
Oh, so the and just in terms of the word vice, you know, I think we debated some different titles, and originally, I think the publisher looking at the term in sort of like what people perceive as vices and what has sometimes been perceived as something immoral or something you shouldn't do, and then looking at why, you know, in this book, why that isn't the case.
Yes, indeed. So let's go into the book. I'm going to pick on chapter two, wine. So very fine. And then you give us a lovely quote from William Shakespeare: a man cannot make him laugh, but that's no marvel. He drinks no wine. Well said, William Shakespeare. So talk to me about wine, because I love wine, but I got to admit that I can't just stick to one glass a day. If I have a glass, I'm going to have two. Is that terrible?
Well, I would say I'll let Eric finish this, but I'll start by saying, no, it's of course not terrible. Even having three or four occasionally is not terrible.
Right.
Your body will detoxify and so on and so forth. Over-consuming every single day is not healthy.
Yes.
But one or two glasses is perfectly fine.
Okay, good. Because this is me, and I'm not talking, this is not for everybody, but I find that I'll have a glass of wine like I did last night and then have two. And then I can go for weeks, for days, maybe weeks, with not having any wine at all. I do like wine a great deal, but sometimes I just don't want to have any. So I guess sort of moderation is what you're saying. That's the best way to go, yeah?
Moderation and having fun and not dwelling on it. And in many ways, worrying about having a little extra wine is worse than having a little extra wine.
So talk to me. You start off, Eric, you talk about La Miserable, Victor Hugo's incredible story. You talk about that at the beginning, which is lovely. I love the fact that you give us these historical references and literal references. But talk to me a little bit more about wine, because I think there is some confusion for people over the years, maybe since, I don't know, when it started to become sort of taboo. I think different countries have different thoughts about this, but just give me a little background about how wine became somewhat of a vice.
Well, I think it's, you know, if you look at the history of wine or any beverage, I think people, you know, humans instinctively are drawn to alcoholic beverages. They've been drinking wine and beer for, millennia. And it is something that, obviously when you drink too much of it, people behave in ways that are sometimes fun, but sometimes also obnoxious and unsettling. So it's kind of always this thing of, you know, people saw that wine could get you drunk and could be dangerous. So I think people, you know, advised you to avoid it in a lot of ways. And it became something that, you know, you weren't, were asked to avoid because people were worried about people having a problem with it. It is something, though, like you mentioned, the other countries. You know, I remember reading Les Miserables and thinking, wow, like, this is a horrible prison, but, you know, they're not going to not give the prisoner wine. Like, they'll chain him to a bedpost and make him row in the galleys for years for, like, a minor offense, but, you know, they won't. He still gets wine because that's sort of, I think, culturally, you know, it's such an ingrained part of certain cultures. And I think in those cultures, you know, not that, you know, you can't drink too much then, but I think there's a different sort of relationship with alcohol sometimes. We talk about the book, different communities in Italy where people, some of the most long-lived individuals in the world, they have a glass of wine or two as part of their daily ritual. And it's not something where they're, you know, it's not something where they're going to a college frat party and getting wasted, but they're sitting down and watching the sunset with a friend or a family member, and they're really, you know, enjoying the experience of the drink. I think that's what makes a difference with wine and other beverages.
I want to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about chapter four, which is titled Sleep, Life's Meditation. And the reason I want to talk about this is that I think sleep is one of those subjects that we don't discuss enough. We're going to do that. Mm-hmm. Right after this.
You are listening to Life Elsewhere with Norman B. You can learn more about this program at lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dr. Harry Ofgang and Eric Ofgang. Their book is called The Good Vices, From Beer to Sex, The Surprising Truth About What's Actually Good For You. Gentlemen, in chapter 4, it's titled Sleep, Life's Meditation. Now, I think for some people, sleep is just one of those things. Oh, it's nighttime, you go to sleep. But for others, it's a big problem. Some people have a lot of trouble sleeping. Some people sleep for a long time. And people like myself, I've never slept for more than 5 hours a night, and I feel perfectly okay. Talk to me about sleep.
Well, different people, over the years in my practice, I've found that having an individual approach to different people works better. So some people do require less sleep and some people more. So when you say things generally, you have to be careful because
yes.
Everyone experiences the same thing. They're interpreting it as if you're talking to them, but we're really generalizing. So each individual might be different. The average person will do better on 7 to 8.5 or even 9 hours sleep, but some people like yourself might do better with 5 hours. Also, a quick nap during the day. I don't know if you take a nap ever, but a 5 or 10 minute nap sometimes can be worth an hour or two at night.
Yes.
So, you know, it really depends on the individual. But the key here is that each person should get the sleep they need. And I always advise people to try when possible to wake up without the alarm clock, and also to try when possible to wake up feeling refreshed and looking forward to the day.
Now, that's so interesting because I set my alarm, but it's just because I have this sort of fear that I won't get up on time. But I always wake up just before the alarm goes off, no matter what time I set the alarm. I guess somewhere inside the back of my brain, my mind tells me you've got to wake up. Is that possible?
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. It's a curious thing. That I now want to move on to a chapter which I find very interesting, and this is chapter 6, Coffee. Hug a mug. I love coffee. I experiment with coffee. I grind my own beans. It's just coffee is a great enjoyment for me. But you talk about this in your book, and you give lots of information. And I'd like, Eric, can you talk about coffee?
Yeah, coffee is one of those, is one of my favorite chapters to write. It's such a wonderful beverage, so universal in so many ways. And it's been shown, you know, time and again to be very healthy for us, despite some, you know, perception out there and some studies that were old studies that were shown to be flawed. It is... it does appear that coffee in moderation is very healthy. There's even some indications that coffee not in moderation is maybe not as healthy, but not even unhealthy if you drink, you know, more than 3 cups a day or something like that. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of downside. There could be, you know, I'm sort of, you know, I don't drink more than 3 cups a day.
Yeah.
In general. But it is just this great beverage that it's a joy to drink. One of the things to remember is, you know, coffee by itself, and it sounds like you're doing this with, you know, grinding your own beans and things like that. Coffee itself isn't bad for us. Sometimes what we put in it
yes,
is, you know, so
yes.
If you're loading it with cream and sugar, then, you know, it's more becoming a sweet drink with coffee added. And if you're really, you know, if you're having coffee with a little cream even, that's fine. But you don't want to have too much sugar.
Most studies that are coming out show that drinking lots of coffee has a lot of health benefits and very few health problems
yes.
associated with it.
Well, there's two things I want to follow up on, and one is chocolate because it has some of the same ingredients, but some of the same attributes that coffee has. I want to get to that in a moment. But before we get to chocolate,
yes.
Eric, you just mentioned something which I think is so important. You said putting sugar in coffee. Now, again, I'm going to speak for myself. I have never, ever put sugar in tea or coffee ever since I was a child. Never didn't like it. But some people love sugar, and you do a chapter. It's chapter 8, Sweet Tooth Bonanza, Honey, Maple Syrup, and Sugar Cane. My question to you is, and I want to get into this a little bit more, but my question to you is, how is it possible that some people like myself really, I'm not bothered about sweet things. I don't have to have sweet things. I don't have to add sugar in my coffee or tea. But some people can't live without it. Do you have any understanding of that, what that's about?
Well, sugar has a, I think we're naturally drawn to sugar. It's an evolutionary purpose. It gives us energy. So I think a lot of people are very drawn to try to consume instinctually as much sugar as they can. You know, their bodies are sort of subtly telling us to do that. Of course, not everyone. You know, it sounds like, certainly some people are more drawn to savory things rather than sweet things.
Yes.
And that can happen. But I think a lot of us are, you know, instinctually drawn to sweet food, sugar, maple syrup, honey, etc. And it's just a matter of, you know, finding the right ways to consume those and work with that sweet tooth rather than against it.
But we recommend, like you mentioned, we recommend against, when possible, having it with coffee, because, and having only a little bit, having darker chocolate wherever possible, because let's take coffee, especially if you are grinding your own beans and brewing it properly, it's a delicious drink. It's like a fine wine.
Yes.
You can savor it. And adding a ton of chocolate kind of, at least for us, ruins it. But people enjoy it, and there is something to enjoyment. So we're not, we don't proselytize, and we don't, you know, scold people if they add a little bit of sugar, but it's best to enjoy it the way you have mentioned. You enjoy it, and that's in its purest state.
Well, so as we're talking about sweets, let's move on now to chocolate, because from reading your book, I understand that there's a lot of attributes that chocolate has are quite similar to coffee. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, I'll let Eric finish up, but basically the caffeine derivative in chocolate is much like the caffeine derivative in coffee, not as strong, and it's a slightly different chemical makeup, but they're methylxanthines, and so that's why it kind of gives you a boost. And also it has a lot of the similar benefits of coffee, in that it improves cognition. There's a myriad of things that it will help with, benefit people throughout their life. So a little bit of chocolate, particularly dark chocolate, is quite healthy.
A lot of people are going to be pleased with that. We're talking to Dr. Harry Ofgang and Eric Ofgang. The book is called The Good Vices from Beer to Sex, The Surprising Truth About What's Actually Good for You. I want to ask you one last question, Harry and Eric, and that is, was there anything that sort of came to light for you as you were doing your research and putting this book together?
For me, I think it was just sort of, and I knew this a little bit from my career in general, but I think the book really drove home how much, I think there's a tendency from a layperson to look at a study that comes out from maybe a Harvard or Yale and think, oh, wow, they looked at 30,000 people, they found, this is good for you or this is bad for you, sort of case closed.
Yes.
And very rarely is that the case. So, you know, the studies are very often limited, and we talk about, you know, and we always advise people to sort of, you know, be skeptical even of the studies we include in the book. So a lot of time you want to look at a wide range of studies and sort of use common sense and see, you know, what seems to be working in the real world and outside of those studies. So that was something big for me. And then the other thing that just came away from all the different things we had looked at in the book and all the chapters we had written was just the importance of being happy in life and how that actually is something you should think about in terms of health and trying to do things you enjoy doing, and how so many of the things that we take pleasure in don't have to be guilty pleasures.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Unfortunately, gentlemen, time is up against us. One of the things I do like about your book a great deal is that you are very succinct. You manage to get a lot of information into each chapter, and it is a great read. The book is called The Good Vices from Beer to Sex, The Surprising Truth About What's Actually Good for You. I've been talking to Dr. Harry Ofgang and Eric Ofgang. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Hey there, take a minute to jot down our website address. It's lifeelsewhere.co. Yes, that's C-O. Now go there to gather up the links to all the books and music we feature. And while you're there, subscribe so you can keep up to date with our past and upcoming shows. Next, a conversation about a novel that focuses in on what some call taboo topics. That's right after these words.
You're listening. listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
Author Jill Cement has a new novel. The title, The Body in Question. Now, this is not a large book, but within these pages, you're going to learn such a great deal. Jill cleverly covers topics some may find uncomfortable. Sex, age, and death. Jill Cement, what a pleasure it is to welcome you to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you for having me, Norman.
As I just mentioned, it's a relatively small book, but my goodness, you have packed into a small amount of pages an awful lot of information, a lot of issues. Just reading down my notes here, courtroom drama, truth, love, belief, age, death, seduction, Florida. Let's begin at the beginning. And so can you tell my audience just a little overview of your book without giving too much away?
Well, it's a book about a woman who gets called for jury duty. She is a photographer. She's from New York. She'd been a pretty well-known photographer, and she's married. And her husband is 30 years her senior, and he is a well-known journalist who's retired. He had come down to teach at the university. They live in Gainesville. She gets called to jury duty, and she starts to flirt with one of the other people who've been called for jury duty. And, you know, it's an innocent flirtation sort of to kill time, and they both end up on a sequestered murder trial where they begin a furtive, very intense affair. And it's, you know, that part of the book is about both the trial, which is kind of a gruesome trial in the sense that it's these two sisters who, one of which, or maybe both of them, killed their youngest brother. And it's about trying, the first half of the book is about trying really hard to be a good citizen and a jurist while you're falling like completely into this sexual fugue. So I thought that would be an interesting way of doing a jury trial. And then the book goes on after the jury. It's the ramifications of what happens when there is a really huge public trial like George Zimmerman or the Casey trial. Anthony Casey. What was her name?
Casey Anthony.
Casey Anthony, yes. Trial. Yeah. You know, and I was really fascinated to see what is it like to be a juror sequestered? And so that was part of it. And then afterward, there's a kind of fury about what the jurors decide if people have been watching the case on news. And I try to cover that, and I'm trying not to give away too much, so I'll stop there. But it has tremendous ramifications for not only her and her lover, but also her and her husband.
Yes. Let's now get into it, because I've got lots of questions. The book is called The Body in Question. We're talking to Jill Cement. Let's start with the fact that in the beginning, in the first part of the book, you give your main characters, you don't tell us their names. You give us their jury names or the nicknames that the other jury members give them. Now, this is a great ploy. It really is a clever way to, in some respects, disguise who they are, but at the same time, tell us a lot about who they are. For instance, the female character is C2 and the male character is F17. Talk to me, Jill, about doing that, because I've already answered my own question, because it is rather clever, but it gives us a sort of a different dimension to the characters that you talk about so much in the book.
Well, I thought it would be an interesting way to do it, because there is, you know, you're looking at, even though you're deeply inside C2's point of view,
yes,
you're also looking at the trial as an outsider, and because they want to keep these people anonymous, I thought it would be really good to keep their names anonymous from the reader too, so that sense of being outside of this thing played into it.
What was really clever about it, and this is one of the things that I think just comes across in the book, that you don't give us their names at the beginning. You do in the, it's sort of a surprise at the second half of the book, we find out their actual names. But as you're reading C2 and F17, you give little glimpses of who they are and what they are. And because, this is my reading on it, because you didn't give us their names, you in some respects ask the reader to sort of fill out the characters, who these people are. Was that intentional?
It's always intentional in my writing, because part of defining a character is, if you give people too much information about a character, then the character is no longer a character. It's sort of a muddle.
Yes.
And so, you know, part of it is shaping it. And also, it's, what would you convey to another human being about yourself?
Yes.
And if it isn't something that you would convey, then I don't necessarily think it would be part of characterization, except for one part. The thing that makes fiction different than any other art form is that we get to spy on human consciousness.
Yes, yes.
And that's where the intimacy for me in writing comes in.
And that is such an important ingredient in your book. So let's now focus in on where a lot of the action takes place, or rather, it's almost the non-action. It's the courtroom. And I'm thinking to myself as I'm reading, how much did Jill experience being in a courtroom or being on a jury? Have you actually done that?
I have actually been on two juries and a number of what they call moot juries.
Yes.
M-O-O-T. It's juries that, my brother had been a public defender in Manhattan when I lived in New York, and they would always need jurors that would come and sit through a made-up trial to tell the lawyers what they were doing right and wrong.
Yes.
And so, you know, I got behind the scenes, and the way in which the jury, you know, we had to analyze ourselves in front of the lawyers. And so I got a lot of information there. And it's a really, I mean, it's one of the greatest things that a human being can do during their life. It, you know, serve in the Army and serve as a juror.
Yes.
And those are two extraordinary things. And I honestly, I didn't know how to write about being a jurist. I thought about this idea for years. It wasn't until The Love Affair that I realized how I could create the tension necessary to make it into a, because actually serving on a jury and witnessing trials is not the most interesting thing in the world.
Yes.
And you know, the courtroom drama that happens on Law and Order isn't at all what happens in the courtroom, but it's equally as interesting.
Anybody that's been in a courtroom knows how it can just drag on and on and on. It goes backwards and forwards. And if you're not actually in the legal profession, it just seems utterly boring. You convey some of that to us, but you also convey the strangeness that goes on between the jurors and the other personnel that are in the courtroom. The jurors, you give them their pet names or nicknames that the jurors themselves, for instance, Cornrow, the school teacher, the church lady, you give them these names, and we configure our own ideas of what they are, who they are, and how they're going to finally judge the young lady.
First of all, this is my first Florida book.
Yeah.
You know, I'm from New York. I moved down here. I couldn't figure out how to write about Florida until this book. And those characters are people that I, you know, they were really fresh to me when I first moved to Florida. It's a context that's so outside of the realm of my experience.
Yes.
And so I think that there are certain types in every city that if you want to, you know, or every, you know, major city and stuff. But there's also this, there's a kind of type of Central Florida.
Yes.
And I really want it, you know, it's an extraordinary, I've come to really love this place. And I wanted to do it honor by being accurate.
I am talking to Jill Cement. Her book is called The Body in Question. It's an intriguing book. It's an intriguing novel. And you cover subjects which, in some respects, are taboo. You talk about gruesome death. You talk about teenage girls that murder their young brother. I want to get to those details in a moment. You also talk about an illicit love affair. And you also go into great detail about aging and death. Let's start with the love affair between Juror C2 and Juror F17. What can you tell us that possibly the audience might be intrigued by? Because I just find that it's so passionate, yet there's something which is holding C2 back the whole time.
Well, she's held back because she is married to someone that she loves dearly. And she loves this man dearly. They've had a really long marriage, a huge span of age difference between them. But she married him when she was 24. And they're coming to the end of his life.
Yes.
And she goes off onto a jury. And this is, for her, a vacation. She's been taking care of him. And so she sees this almost as this great relief. And, you know, the intensity of being in a murder trial is like being at war.
Yes.
And when people are at war, you know, things like flirtations or affairs intensify. And so I think that one of the reasons that it's so, their affair is so intense is because they can only escape into each other's rooms. Like, you know, in the middle of the night when they're sure the deputies and the other jurors are asleep and none of the doors are allowed to be locked.
Yeah.
And so she sleeps with this man every night that she can during the trial. And then on the weekends, those are when they have visits from the family.
Yes.
And they have conjugal visits. And so she's kind of bouncing back and forth. And I think that's what gives the love affair its tension.
One of the other parts that you describe so well is the intimacy between her and him, C2 and F17, is that they never see one another naked. They're in darkness the whole time until I think it's their last rendezvous when they actually see one another. That conjures up such incredible images of how you could be passionate about somebody without actually seeing them.
If you're married and you're having an affair, it might be easier if you never see the other person.
Yeah.
You know, it might be exactly what would allow you to do something without guilt.
Jill, I want to talk about the sex in your book because it's explicit without being explicit. And as I'm reading it, I'm wondering about that because there's a sort of eroticism about it. Even when they're sitting in the jury room or in the courtroom, she looks at him and he gazes at her every so often. He clearly is infatuated with her. But there's a sort of, there's a kind of, as I said, an eroticism. There's an electricity that is going on. But you do it with so delicately and with, you don't get into sort of gross details or graphic details.
Well, you know, one of the things is he's an anatomy professor. And she is a photographer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in one way, she's been put in, for her to sleep with him, she's in blindness because they have to keep the drapes really closed and they're blackout drapes as they have in so many econologies. And so she's been robbed of her great power, okay, which is her eyes. And that, I think, charges the eroticism between them.
Yes.
And also his intimacy with the body is another way in which, you know, he's going to think about the body. Remember, he's taken bodies apart.
Yes.
An anatomy professor. He does, you know, that's his job, is to know every nerve and every cell in the body. And so I thought that kind of combination of blindness and thorough knowledge of the corporal body would be a way to do eroticism. At one point, he dissects her, and I think I'm most proud of that scene. He doesn't dissect her, but it's a kind of sexual play that they do together.
Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I was just about to say about that scene. That scene is so incredibly charged. He traces on her back. He traces where he would cut a cadaver. That is so incredible.
I mean, one, in order to be able to write all these scenes, I went to the University of Florida and was allowed to go through into a anatomy class. So I was able to to see what it's like to cut skin, and to, you know, they really were very welcoming of me, and it's an extraordinary experience. My own husband had just passed away. I mean, part of this book is I knew that my husband would die while I was writing it. And I knew he would pass away while he was doing it. And, you know, that was when, whatever the plot of the book was, I knew that I would have to deal with that. And so, you know, he actually was in a freezer at the university while I went to the dissection place. So it was one of the most surreal experiences.
Oh my goodness.
And I think that is, I mean, it you know, was a hugely emotional experience. And I think that I really studied dissection at that point. So I think I was able to put that into him and allow him to have, once you've had that experience, the body's different for you.
Yes. I want to get into this a little further about death and about aging. And we're going to take a quick break. My guest is Jewel Cement. Her book is called The Body in Question. When we return, we're going to talk about death and aging right after this.
We love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jewel Cement. Her new book is called The Body in Question. It's a novel. It's a short book, but my goodness, is it a powerful book. You discuss in the book, and you talk about in incredible detail about aging and about death. The scenes where, well, we're now going to give her name, Hannah, where her husband is dying. It's, I don't know that I've read anything before which really, really summons up for me just the pain of watching somebody die. I've watched a parent die very close up, and you give to me, and you give to the reader, details that I don't know that you've experienced unless you've actually experienced it. I'd love to hear from you, Jill, about that. It's about writing that.
Well, you know, I'm going to talk in a hypothetical.
Yes.
Because what Hannah did was against the law.
Yes.
So, you know, I can't. So it's, everything I say is a hypothetical.
Yes.
Okay. So if my husband had been really sick, okay, there's my if.
Yes.
You know, I experienced this. My husband was 30 years older than me, and I, you know, he was 91 when I started the book, and most of my books take about 3-4 years. So, I mean, it's a pretty good guess he wasn't going to make it to the end.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things I have felt strongly about is letting people die at home. And so I was really determined to let him die at home. Mm. And you can't have someone die at home unless you've got a lot of help, and hospice is an amazing thing.
Yeah.
But I also really wanted to write about that experience. And, you know, I took notes while I was hypothetically helping him let go. And so it's a very accurate portrait, as accurate to my own experience as I could get. I mean, a writer is so merciless, okay? You know, and my husband was a painter. Mm-hmm. Actually, a fairly well-known painter. His name was Arnold Meshes. And he, you know, he not only gave me permission to take notes while he was dying. And so, you know, it was an extraordinary experience, one of the things I'm proudest of in my life, because there's nothing better than helping someone not suffer. Mm. And I, you know, it was, you know, what you're looking for as a writer are experiences that have changed you. And so I, you know, when I started the book, I certainly didn't know how it would end, because I didn't know how it would end in life.
Yes, yes.
And so I hope I conveyed that experience, because death is something that faces all of us, and it is not something to be feared. Mm. We can all be frightened of it, but it's part of the life experience, and I wanted to put as much of that as I could in.
There's something else which is so important in the death in the book and the death in your private life, and that is the age difference. Now, this, in a lot of respects, for a lot of people, I think you'll agree, is almost a taboo subject. But I think...
Oh, my God. It's hugely taboo. Now, with Me Too, it's hugely taboo.
Yes. Can you talk about that, Jill? Because I think it's something which is not discussed enough, but you have written about it. So I'd like to hear from you about the taboo.
Well, first, I have to just add that there's a piece in Harper's in the June issue that's by me about exactly this issue.
Mm.
I met my husband when I was 16.
Yes.
And he was 46 or 47. And I wrote a memoir about it called Half a Life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finished this book, I was sort of thinking what kind of novel I wanted to write next. And I decided just to write a couple of essays just to take a break from novel writing. And one sort of, that's the one that's in Harper's this month, and it stuck. And what it is I realized, only because of the Me Too movement and all this talk, that my first memoir, the memoir called Half a Life About Us, had so many lies in it.
Yes.
I mean, it had lies about, not that I intended to be lies, but because writing about the age difference, you know, if I wrote about it actually, my husband would look like a pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
So in this weird way, I started to change little things to make us come across as acceptable in 1995 when I wrote it. And it's really interesting because today it's not acceptable.
Yes.
But yes. I had a 45-year wonderful marriage, so I don't know what you do with that.
I'd like to hear from you, Jill, what you think, why society has such a frowns upon the big age gap.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I think on a micro level, okay, people are really worried that their daughters are going to end up taking care of old men as they die, okay? And that's the truth. Then those fears that those parents have when they see their young daughter, or in some cases, I even know young sons
mm-hmm.
who are giving up having children because they're marrying older women,
mm-hmm.
okay? So I think that on the family level, it's a huge problem, okay? Because, I, you know, for parental love as well as, you know, other things. But society-wise, I remember going to my first party with my husband, okay, like a Christmas party, where they offered everyone, like, what do you want to drink? You know, martini, et cetera, and they brought me a glass of milk, okay?
Yes, yes.
So, I mean, people were horrified and shocked, and I think they're horrified and shocked because... I think the one thing that no one's taking into account is that, you know, learning doesn't just go from elderly or old to young. Learning also goes from very young to old. I mean, I think older people learn from younger people. And I think that's what really, you know, that's the thing that it's not supposed to happen. I learn from my students. I mean, I you know, being around young people is a really exhilarating thing, and I think that people think of that as a kind of vampirish thing, that the old man is drinking the blood of the young woman, the vitality.
Yes.
And in truth, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm not quite sure why it's taboo, but it's not taboo all the time in all cultures, and it's more taboo with women to younger men.
That's very true. And there's also, there's peer pressure as well. Your friends will give you some very cryptic observations that I don't think your parents come to think of. Let's change subjects here for a moment and let everybody know that I'm talking to Jill Sements. The book is called The Body in Question. It really is an absolutely wonderful novel. I've enjoyed every page of this. One word that I wrote down and whilst I was reading this book, and I kept coming back to, and that is belief. And I want to explain what I mean by that after we take a quick break.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. Let us know what you think of our show. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jill Cement. Her book is called The Body in Question. It's a relatively short book, but as I've mentioned earlier on, it packs a big punch. It covers a number of issues and serious issues. And Jill does it very succinctly. It's that economy of words that I love so much. One word that I wrote down as I read in your book and kept underlining is belief. Because C2, Hannah, and F17, Graham, they're jurors. But they both have beliefs about not only their own lives, but also the life of Anchor, the young lady that's on trial. And their beliefs are whether she's guilty or not. And I'd like to hear from you, Jill, about belief, about the belief in justice, about the belief in right and wrong and truth.
You know, you go to a jury with a whole lifetime of experience and observation, human observation. And so you go to a jury prejudiced. And you think that truth is really easy to discover in a trial, and it's not. You know, you never know the whole truth. And in some ways, you know, legal trials are not about truth. It's about perception.
Yes.
And so, you know, I just wanted, you know, to try and convey how even people doing the very best job cannot see things the same way. And one of the most extraordinary things about the jury system is everybody has to come to an agreement. And so people have to actually break down and give up their belief system in order to reach a conclusion in the trial. And that's really different than in life. And I thought that that was a really interesting way of exploring these larger issues. And, you know, one of the things that, it doesn't give away much of the plot, but Hannah and Graham, or F-17 and C-2, they are so in love and they're having this impassioned affair, but they never, ever discuss the trial because that, even though they're not supposed to have sex either, they're discussing the trial would really be breaking their word of honor to the judge. But then they find themselves during deliberations on opposite sides. And I thought, whoa, if I was kind of falling in love with a guy and we were sitting through this trial and he turned out to not agree with me, could I love somebody who didn't agree with me?
Yes.
I'm such a vital piece of information, you know, such a vital thing.
Yes. And isn't it, you write it so well, because isn't it surprising when you are, I guess, in love with somebody or you're in lust with somebody, and then you discover that they think differently to you. That's just, what an upset that is.
It's really big. And this would be, it would mean that every glance that they had at each other during the trial, every, you know, unspoken word, she's thinking, he's thinking the same thing as her.
Yes.
And
yes.
He's not.
Yes. Was this, Jill, a difficult book to write?
It's really a compelling book to write, I've got to tell you. They're all difficult in their own way, sitting down. But, you know, this book was such, I've never been so compelled to write something. It just, you know, it took me through my husband's illness.
Yeah.
And his death and the aftermath of grief. So my own state was intense during the writing of it. And so it's never difficult. All the difficulties in writing are usually technical. And I know that sounds, you know, once you've tapped into what you want to say, the difficulty is how to say it in a way that, you know, how to create what you do. What writing is you have an emotion inside of you and you try to give it a form so that another person, a stranger looking at that form, will experience the same emotion inside of them. And so the difficult part is how to create either in language, music, whatever you're doing, how to create a form that a complete stranger will come upon and experience what you experienced or some kind of close emotion to it. it's a conversation. That's the communion of art.
Yes.
And you can, the thing that makes it extraordinary is, you know, 200 years after you're dead, someone can pick up your book and experience the emotion you had while you were writing it. And to me, that's what the beauty of art is.
Yes, actually.
So I don't know if that answers it.
No, that answers it very well, Jill. It really does. Before we wrap the conversation up, somewhat of a lighter topic, and that
sure.
is, I know that you've written a screenplay. I often will read a book, and in my own mind, and I think this is the power of writing, in my own mind, I will summon up characters. I'll think about it as a movie or as a TV series. I couldn't mm-hmm. help doing it with your book, of course. I'm thinking this would be a series that I would binge watch and probably cry many times as I'm watching it. And I'm just wondering whether you've been optioned the screenplay for this or in that direction. Is thoughts about that?
Well, you have a film agent and they just start sending the book around when the book comes out. So it doesn't really happen ahead of time. So that I can't say. I mean, I've had one of my books made into a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, you know, it was an extraordinary experience. I mean, the book was about two elderly Jews in their little dachshund during a supposed terrorist attack while they were trying to sell their apartment in New York.
Yeah.
But their being old Jews was really a part of the, you know, who they were.
Right.
And Morgan Freeman and Diane Keaton end up playing them. And my dachshund, that Diane Keaton and Morgan Freeman played two old Jews. I could get into that, but my dachshund was played by a terrier, and that really upset me.
Yes, I can totally understand that.
That put me over the edge.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's look forward to possibly this being turned into a movie or to a TV series. If it does, I hope they keep to the script and cast it just the way you, Jill Cement, wants it to be.
That would be wonderful.
It's really is a good read. I do recommend it, and I've really enjoyed talking with you. My guest has been Jill Cement. Her book is called The Body in Question. Jill Cement, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really do enjoy bringing you Life Elsewhere, and thank you so much for listening, and a large thank you to my guests. Now, you have a number of choices when you want to hear this or any of our shows again. You can go to our affiliate stations, NPR One, Apple Podcasts, and Mixcloud. All the details and links are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Now, make sure that you're ready, because in a few moments, the announcer will give you my email address, and I'd certainly like to hear from you. Send me your thoughts. Maybe you've got an idea for a show. Just let me know. Till next time, be well, be good, and don't forget, be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.